How can we as Christians be faithful? How can we, in a world where so many people ignore God, in a world where so many people reject God, in a world where so many people misunderstand God, in a world where so many people worship false gods or no God at all, how is it that we in this room, how is it that we in this church can be faithful? How can we do that? The book of Daniel is an Old Testament book. The book of Daniel is a book that was written about 600 years before Christ came. But it is incredibly relevant to us as Christians living in our day. Let's place it in the storyline, the timeline of redemptive history for a moment. And I'll try to keep this introduction to the book short. I don't want anybody dozing off. I don't want to lose anybody before we get into the text here this morning. But if you look at it in redemptive history, you think about, you know, the creation. You think about the fall in Genesis 3, where Adam and Eve rebel against God and God brings the curse. And from there, you have these two lines, you know, that are set out. The people of God and the people that aren't God's. The people that God will save and the people that God won't save. And you have these two lines going throughout Old Testament history and even throughout all time. And you move forward after Adam and you come to the gospel. God saves Adam and Eve. God clothed them with these animal skins. And you see these movements in Scripture, these covenants in Scripture where God comes to Noah and God comes to Abraham and God comes to Israel at Mount Sinai and God comes to David. And God has said more about the covenant and God has said more about salvation and God has said more to his people and more is known. And then finally, as the people of God have, you know, been pilgrims and sojourners and have been in Egypt in slavery and are set free and wandered around the wilderness, they come into the promised land. God brings them into the promised land and they have a few generations where they're in there living in Israel. But as you know, the people of God did not do very well. The northern tribes, the tribes split after David and Solomon, the tribes split and you have the 10 northern tribes. And they never had a good king. And they set up false worship and they worshiped in false places and they worshiped false gods. And God was never pleased with them. And they went into captivity in 722. The Lord brought the Assyrians down and they were a brutal people and they were taken captive there in 722 BC. And then the southern tribes that had Jerusalem, that had the temple, that had things right, Judah and Benjamin, they lasted a bit longer and they had some good kings. They had a lot of bad kings too, but they had some good kings and things went better for them. But still, God was displeased with them. And in 586, they were taken as a nation away to Babylonian captivity. Assyrian captivity for the northern tribes, Babylonian captivity for the southern tribes. And this is the time that we find ourselves in the book of Daniel, when the southern tribes are taken into captivity. And this is the first attack or raid or besiegement in 605 BC. It's 605 BC when Daniel is taken captive. And we'll get into that. We'll talk a little bit more about this. But I just want to say a couple more things. What's the book of Daniel about? The book of Daniel is a book about wisdom. You know, I said it's in the prophets, the major prophets. That's where it is in our English Bible. But in the Hebrew Bible, they place the book of Daniel among the writings. And among the writings, you find the wisdom literature. And so Daniel, for the Jewish people, really would be about wisdom. How to live wisely. how to live wisely in captivity, how to live wisely in a culture, in a place that is where you're surrounded by people that don't believe in the same God that you believe in, that don't have the same values, that don't have the same morals. It's a book about how to live wisely in that kind of environment. Now, there's more to it than that, but for our purposes, that's a pretty good thing to focus on. It's a book about how to be holy, how to live a holy life in the midst of chaos, in the midst of uncertainty. And I want to say, just first off here this morning, I just want to drive home the point that you don't need a certain kind of culture to be a faithful Christian. You don't need a certain kind of society to be just so, or the way you like it, to be faithful to your God. In fact, for 2,000 years, and more than that, there have been faithful believers living in chaotic times and chaotic situations. And they have remained faithful. Now, we may like things to be a bit different, but we don't need them to be different. To be holy, to be faithful, to be men and women, boys and girls of character is possible for us anywhere, anytime. Why? Because God is always present. God is always with his own people. God doesn't need a certain environment. God doesn't need a certain situation to help you stand, to help you be faithful, to encourage you, to give you hope. He's always there. And this book is about that. How to be wise, how to be holy. But this book is about God. First and foremost, this book is about God. It's about his holiness, his faithfulness, his power, his sovereignty, right? That's what this book is about. Hopefully we'll see that. You know, think about it. Listen, if you're Israel in these days, you're probably thinking, as you see your nation overrun, as you see your temple sacked, the place where God lived in the world, where God dwelt in the world, where God was honored and, you know, sacrifices were offered and he was pleased, and you see that destroyed and you're taken off into captivity, you have to be thinking, are we done? Is God totally done with us? Like, what about the promises of God? How is God going to do this? How is God going to be faithful? I thought we were the people of God. Are we done? Has God gone back on his word to Abraham and to Moses and to David and these different things? Are we done? And so it's about the faithfulness of God. It's about how God takes the long view of salvation and does whatever he needs to do to save his own people. Daniel's about all of these different things. And ours is a response. So I said, how are we to be holy in a place like this? Is to focus on the holiness of God. How are we to be faithful in a situation like this? We focus on the faithfulness of God. How are we to live uprightly? We focus on God. We have to focus on God. And I know in the days in which we live, it is very easy to get consumed, to get caught up in what's going on all around us. And we have to be first and foremost focused on God. You have to be. You absolutely have to be. What's the narrative that's controlling your life right now? What's the narrative that's driving you? What's the narrative that's taking your peace or giving you peace? What's the narrative that's taking your hope or giving you hope? What's the narrative that's moving you right now? Because there is one that is. There is a narrative that dominates your life right now. There just simply is. And I'm asking which one it is. Is it the narrative where God creates and saves and keeps and renews all things at the end of the age? Or is it something different? And Daniel speaks clearly, clearly to this issue, to this matter. And so, we're going to look at three things this morning. We're going to spend more time on the first thing than the second and third thing. And I know our time is shorter because of communion today, but this is a really important chapter. So point one, given over point two, is about given favor, and point three is about being given learning and skill. In the first seven verses, we see the idea of being given over. And it says there in verse one, I mean, we just jump right into trouble at the very beginning. There's no messing around. I kind of like this. Like, just jump right into it. Tell me what's going on. Tell me what the issue is. No long. Sometimes you watch a movie and it's like, man, this movie is so slow to get going. Like, if truth be told at home, like, if it takes too long, I'm done. I'm out. I'm turning it off. But right here in Daniel, it's like, boom, right into it. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. Verse 1, you have besieging taking place. You have a country that's coming against the people of God in the city of God, the place where God has put his own name, said, build the temple there. That's where I want to dwell. That's where I want to hang out. And King Nebuchadnezzar, this hot new king of the Babylonian Empire, comes against Israel, comes against Judah and Benjamin, comes against Jerusalem and says, you're going to be mine. You're going to serve me. And in this first deportation, what he did was, he didn't even take the king at this time. He took some utensils and he took some young promising men, right? You take the promising young men, the promising young students, the up-and-comers that'll be the next generation, and you take them away to take away their power. Take away the best and the brightest, not only to cripple Judah, but to bless Babylon. And so that's what he does. Nebuchadnezzar is just doing what Nebuchadnezzar thought he would do. Hey, by the way, that's what nations have always done. Nations have always warred and been at war. And it's always been the strongest rule and reign. It's always been that way. Always. And so Nebuchadnezzar just did what Nebuchadnezzar would do. He came to conquer this little tiny nation. Like, you're going to pay tribute to me, and you people are going to be mine, right? But back of that, and really most importantly for our story is what we read in verse 2, right? Jehoiakim, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, verse 1, came and besieged it. And verse 2, it was the Lord that gave Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, into his hand. Like, you're not going to see that on the news. That's not the report that you're going to hear on the local media outlet. That's not the, you're not going to physically see God, like, walking him over. But that's what's happening behind the scenes. The reason that Nebuchadnezzar was able to come to Jerusalem and take the people, take the king, take the utensils, is because God gave them over. God gave them over. That's what God did. And it's so important for us to understand what God reveals about himself, for what God reveals about history, for what God reveals about his purposes and his plans. Why did he do this? I mean, why did we read this? How is this helpful at all? It's helpful for a lot of reasons. According to the blessings and cursings of Leviticus and Deuteronomy and other places in the Mosaic Law, they were disobedient. Generally speaking, they were disobedient for a long period of time. And God said, that's enough. According to specific promises to specific kings, God said, I'm going to come and I'm going to take you into exile and captivity. And now God is being faithful to his promises. And I think it's important to stop here for a couple of minutes and talk about this. How is this helpful? How is it helpful to know that God is doing these things according to what he said he would do in Scripture? First of all, it's a reminder that God is God. I think this is terribly important for us. I was thinking about 9/11. Remember 9/11? The Twin Towers came down, and it was a really hard time for our country. And it was really hard for so many people to make sense of things. And I don't know if you remember, and it seems like forever ago, but one of the mantras, one of the things that you would hear people say back then was, God bless America. Do you remember that? Everybody everywhere seemed to be saying, God bless America. Well, that seems like a different lifetime, actually, to me. But one of the things that R.C. Sproul said about that, that I thought was really helpful, is Sproul said that, you know, we make a place for God in nature. We can make a place for God in history. We can make a place for God among the affairs of human beings. But that place is restricted to blessing. God, bless America. And we have no doctrine of God ever cursing. We have no doctrine of God ever bringing judgment. If we do, it's just kind of once in a while, or it's kind of in the back of our minds. But we don't allow God to be God. We like to reinvent him, or we like to speak loudly about certain aspects about who he reveals himself to be and whisper about other things that aren't so intriguing or important to us as people. But God is not just the God of blessing. Because God is holy, because God is righteous, because God is just, because God is sovereign, he's also the God of calamity. He's also the God of judgment. And I think it's important for us to know that and to have that be a part of our understanding as Christians, to be balanced Christians, to be well-grounded, rooted in the word Christians. We have to understand this about God. God is not simply about puppy dogs and, you know, flowers and these different... He's not like that. There's a serious element to God. God is God. God is holy. God is just. God is righteous. God keeps his promises. And he keeps his promises sometimes to bless and other times to curse. And are we okay with that? Are we okay with that? Maybe we have to wrestle with that. We probably have to wrestle with that. But we have to be okay with that. We have to let God be God. We have to let God be God. And so, God is still faithful. And I want you to see that. As he judges his country, as he allows these people, as he allows the utensils. And I think this is really interesting. Just as kind of a small note here. The Lord allows some of the instruments. You see, he gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with, notice, some of the vessels in the house of God. And notice, some of the, you know, the vessels that they would use for sacrifices and different things, the king Nebuchadnezzar took them back to his temple and put them in his house of worship. And the idea was, our God is stronger than your God. See, that's what they would do when they go to work. Our God is stronger than your God. Your God is defeated. Your God is weak. Our God, Baal, Marduk, whatever, they had a whole pantheon of gods over there. But our gods are stronger than yours. And so these utensils go into that house of God. Little g, God. And I think it's interesting the way Daniel writes this, that he says here, he brought them into the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, little g, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God at the end of verse 2. Shinar, and you say, what's Shinar? Well, Shinar is that place that you read about where all the people came to build the Tower of Babel. Nobody calls it Shinar anymore. But Daniel's pointing us back to that time when those guys gathered together, where God said, spread out, take my name to the edges of the earth. And they said, no, we're going to gather here on the plain of Shinar, and we're going to build a tower. And you remember, they built that ziggurat, that building, whatever it was, up into the heavens, and God came down in judgment. And he cursed them, and he spread them out all over the world. He changed their language and spread it out all over the world. And then, in Genesis 12, Abraham's there. And the blessings are to Abraham to be a blessing to not just the nation of Israel, but to the whole world. And I think Daniel's pointing us to this idea that there are all the other gods, and there's the true and the living God. There are all these other ways that people live and all these other ways that people worship, but there's the true and the living God. And at times, listen, this is really important, so tune in for me. for a second, sometimes it looks like our God loses. Sometimes it looks like our God is defeated. But it's only because he allows it to be so. It's only because he allows it to be the case in order that someday, in some way, he can bring a grand reversal. Listen, the true and the living God, was he not able to overthrow Nebuchadnezzar? Was he not able to send an angel and wipe out 85,000 soldiers if he wanted to? Was he not able to guard his own temple? Of course he was. But he allowed himself to be reproached, to take shame, so that he might do something bigger and grander and greater down the road. And so this man, Nebuchadnezzar, thinks, I've won. But he hasn't won. He has a temporary victory that leads to, as we'll see, a great defeat. You also have these young men that are taken. You have the men, and their names are listed as you go on a little bit further down in verse 7. But you have these men from royal bloodlines. They're from the tribe of Judah, right? And you have Daniel, and his name means God is my judge. And as he's taken away, they rename these kids. And they're probably 14 or 15 years of age. So think eighth grade. Think freshman in high school, okay? In our culture, in our way of thinking about things, that's probably about how old they were. And you can think they're royalty, right? They have Judah's blood. You know, they're in the right family. They're nobility. They're catechized and raised in the faith. And they probably, it seems like, we'll see here, these people are on the right track, right? And then all of a sudden, again, this is the first deportation. All of a sudden, the king shows up from a foreign country. God gives the king of Israel over into his hand and says, I want to take a bunch of your teenagers away from their families, away from their land, away from everything. I want to take them all away and teach them our ways. And so they give them new names. That's one of the things they do. God is my judge. That was Daniel's name. And back then, you know, names meant something. They really did mean something. God is my judge was what Daniel means. But his new name is Bel or Baal, protect the king, right? False gods. Hananiah, his name means God has favored or the Lord is gracious. Great stuff. But his new name, Shadrach, means the command of Aku, right? Another false god. Mishael, his name means who is what God is or who is like the Lord. But they give him a new name, Meshach, which means who is what Aku is, this false god. And then Azariah, the Lord has helped or the Lord is my helper. And his new name, Abednego, means servant of Nebo. And what does it mean when people name people? It means you're under my authority. We talked about that on our Christmas sermon. Like if I name you, I have the authority to name you. You're mine. I own you. And that's one of the things that these guys were doing, was trying to take them away from their identity. You're no longer gods. Change their location. It's Babylon, not Jerusalem. And so this is really important, I think, for our day. As you think about education, as you think about, you know, enculturation, you know, the things that are happening around us, give different materials, contradictory materials. You think about the training that goes on here. You think about the educating that goes on here, this kind of Babylonian college or seminary, this three-year program where they have to learn all the ways of Babylon, all the languages and all the magic arts and all of the stuff. And you learn of the false gods and the false worship and the false divination. You learn of the false worldview, the false view of man, the false view of God, the false view of sin, the false view of redemption. All of these things directly opposed to the ways of God. And you think about how many eighth graders, how many freshmen that you know might be able to stand up under those sorts of circumstances. How many young men would be able to be ripped away from everything they knew and retaught everything that was contrary? How do you think they were going to do? How do you think they would do? Sinclair Ferguson talks about four things. These are really important. I just want to bring us kind of to the end before we move into communion this morning. Think about these sorts of things. He talks about four things that they wanted to isolate, indoctrinate, compromise, and confuse. That's what Babylon wanted to do to these young men, so that they might properly serve the way they wanted them to serve in their leadership positions back in Babylon. Isolate, indoctrinate, compromise, confuse. Isolate. Get you away from your family. Get you away from catechesis. Get you away from church. Get you away from Sunday school. Get you away from those people that are walking with the Lord, and get you into a group where people aren't doing any of those things. Isolate. Indoctrinate. Teach you this instead of this. Teach you what we believe instead of what you believe. Make you feel like your old ways. Can you imagine? If you're in Babylon and you're educating Daniel and these other guys, you're saying, wait, our stuff's better. Our God's better because look what we just did to you. We just smashed you. Your God is nothing. All you have is stupid. Right? In our day, it might be your view of things is so antiquated. It's so old. It's so lame. It doesn't make sense. Whatever the case may be. And it's powerful. It's powerful when they can isolate and indoctrinate. It makes you actually feel like the false is true and the true is false. That's why we have to be careful. We have to be careful. We have to be prepared. We have to continue to be in the Word and in prayer and in fellowship. Isolate, indoctrinate, compromise. Forget what's good. Do what's evil. Right is wrong. Wrong is right. Upside down is right side up. That's where you end up. That's what happens. Confuse. You don't know. You don't know right from wrong anymore. I mean, you there was a time where you did know and you just were doing the wrong thing anyway, but you get to a place where you don't even know anymore. You don't even know anymore. You're so lost. You're so confused. And that's what these people were trying to do. But I want to say, in spite of all this, everything had changed for these four young men. And there were others beside them. There were other young men there as well. There were other people that were in that Babylon University. And you might say, well, what didn't change for these young men? Well, what didn't change was God. What didn't change was that God was with his people. God was present. God was in Babylon. We live in a day where we don't have to go to Babylon. Babylon comes to us. Right? That's okay. Because God is in Babylon too. And I really do think that God is giving us a really great opportunity in the church to actually be the church. To actually stand and live the way we actually say we believe. Giving us an opportunity to actually do the things we say we believe. Be the people that we say we are. Again, we don't need a certain culture. We don't need a certain surrounding. We don't need a certain society. We need the church. We need the word. We need the sacraments. We need God. That's what we need. And whether that be in Jerusalem or in Babylon or someplace in between, God is present with his people, and we need to remember that. We need to remember it today and remember it every day. God had not left them. We'll see that next week. I wish I could show you. I wish we had time to show you. God had not left them. God had not changed one iota. God was with them, and what's more, God was for them. And we'll see that clearly in the rest of the chapter and in the rest of the book. Can God do such a thing? Yeah, because he's God. Can he allow his people to be taken captive by people that reject the true God? Yeah, because he's God. And we need to recognize and realize we're in the world, dear friends, but we're not of the world. We're not to be conformed to the world, but we're to be transformed by the renewing of our minds so that we might know what is the good and perfect will of God. Our God has transferred us from the kingdom of darkness to the kingdom of light, has transferred us from the kingdom of death to the kingdom of life, and we must live accordingly. I'll just give you a hint for today as we move into communion. I think this chapter shows us three grand reversals. Some great reversals here at the end of the chapter. As you see there in verse 21, Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus, which means he outlived Nebuchadnezzar and even Babylon. So there's a reversal. This young man that's taken captive outlives that strong king, that strong leader that has taken him captive. He outlives him there. And that's a great reversal. Actually, we'll just stop and talk about that one grand reversal that we'll see, and we'll talk about the others next week. But the greatest reversal of all is a reversal we see in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. The Lord allowed himself to be defeated. The Lord allowed himself to be shamed for a time that he might do this grand work, this great reversal, the greatest reversal of all time. And we are living in a dark and difficult time, but we're also living in a world where there's been a resurrection, where the grand and great reversal has taken place already, and the event that is tied to that great reversal is coming. Jesus will return. And we have to remember every day, as we are pilgrims and sojourners and exiles in the world, this world is not our home, not in its current form. We're just a passing through. It will become our home when the new heavens and the new earth are united at the return of Christ, but not until then. Heaven is our home. Our citizenship is in heaven, Paul says. Jesus says, store up your treasure in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy and thieves do not break in and steal. Ours is to set our hearts and minds and focus on heaven and live in the here and now in light of the there and then. Our tendency is to want to build a foundation and want to, you know, set up our permanent home here. That's not what God has for us. And maybe, just maybe, what's going on now gives us a better opportunity to realize that. The great reversal has taken place. Jesus is coming again to usher in that final victory for all to see. Live accordingly, dear friends. Let's pray.